Welcome everyone to Compox and the podcast that is Wagon Wheel, where we answer your questions on cricket, including, well, anything you've asked, really. I was going to say including certain topics, but it's like, it can be wild on Wagon Wheel. The best way to ask questions on Wagon Wheel, of course, is via Patreon. You can support us there at Good Areas Podcasts. And you can find a way to support us there, and that allows you to ask questions. Or you can do it via Super Chat on the lives if you happen to be in YouTube at the moment. But not Nadika. Nadika has gone with the Patreon option and has asked, in T20s, would the advantage of keepers standing up to bowling speed bowlers be the worth of risking a ball go through for four? It just depends on what you're trying to do. I think if you are looking at a player who is using the crease quite effectively, so coming down like a Ollie Pope type player, or batting way out of their crease like Daryl Mitchell, someone like that, it makes sense to probably, you know, have a bit of a payoff and go, yeah, it's worth doing that on occasions. Coming down the wickets and changing things up. Coming up to stumps and changing things up. But you've just got to weigh that up. You've got to remember that England have a dogmatic plan. And so you could do it to most of their batters, knowing that that would upset them. That's not going to be the case for most players. So you would only do it for maybe one or two. And you're doing it with the risk of, as you say, letting a ball go through for four. And also missing catches. Anytime you come up to the stumps, you are a chance of four byes and a drop catch, right? You are really changing the odds on both of those things. However, the other side of it is that you are putting your team in a situation where that batter is having to do something very differently. So you're constantly weighing those sorts of things up in T20 as you would in anything. Miley Cyrus says, imagine the ICC and MLB decide to do an AFL Gaelic football style international rules crossover. What aspects of each sport would you include, exclude? So for those who don't know, Aussie rules is a weird hybrid of like rugby, Gaelic football, and an Australian sport called Marn Crook that Indigenous people played. But it's close enough to Gaelic football that they had an international tournament where they kind of just changed the rules a little bit, right? And so you use the Gaelic football, which was round, which obviously in Aussie rules football, they do not. You didn't allow tackling because, again, in Gaelic football, you didn't do that. But there were a bunch of other Aussie rules regulations and things that came in. It was really fascinating. Unfortunately, Aussie rules and Gaelic football kind of diverged a little bit physically. You needed skinnier, smaller sort of running guys in Gaelic football, and Aussie rules was getting bigger and stronger. And when the Aussie rules players hit the Gaelic players, then there was a fight at one stage and it wasn't exactly a fair fight. Like, all these things happen. From a baseball perspective, I think the hardest thing is, would you keep the baseball bat, but also the stumps, but play it on a cricket pitch? Is that the best way of doing it? And you would have to work out the distance that is needed to make it so that the fastest bowlers and the fastest pitchers are delivering at the same speed. I think that's probably fair. You'd use a baseball, but it would have to bounce, I suppose. I don't know how well a baseball bounces. I think it bounces okay, doesn't it? It's not quite a cricket ball, but they're tight leather as well. But yeah, that's kind of the way you would do it. I'm trying to think, running between wickets. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how deep you go that much. It's a fascinating concept. Sam says, how did England get their bowling so wrong in the Ashes? It's like the punchline to that joke about a fart in the lift, wrong on so many levels. Firstly, they pick a bowling unit with the idea that Australian pitchers were like 10 of them. Agreed. Secondly, the new ball options state, you know, obviously never going to play all five tests, so they ended up with cast opening unit bowling. I would also argue that they really, even in Atkinson, I don't think is a new ball bowler. I think Atkinson is even a first change bowler. So outside of Jofra Archer and Matthew Potts as a backup when he was available in the squad, I don't think they really ever had, well, I suppose when Wokes wasn't playing. I can't remember when Potts came in anyway. I don't think they actually had new ball bowlers, right? So that's a big part of it. Then within the matches, the plans for how to bowl were awful. I wouldn't just say they were awful. I think it was, I'm going to try and do a podcast with Steve Harmison about this. If the plans that they had was what they were trying to bowl, then they were absolutely ordinary. But is it possible that they had slightly better plans and then it all went to crap anyway, just because of the, you know, the implementation? I talked about this recently. Is it And this is what I want to talk to Harmy about as well. Is it possible that England had slightly better plans, which I think he believes, and they couldn't implement it, which is still an issue? Or is it possible that they had terrible plans and the implementation was terrible? Like, I don't even know. I know it's easy to criticize for the benefit of hindsight, but to get seemingly every decision so wrong almost feels like a performance art. Yeah. I think you're right. I don't think there's a friendly. It is. I think I wrote about it in the Ashes piece, Sam. If you go back and have a look at it, or in the video a couple of days ago, the Ashes timeline piece, the battle for the shoebox. Were they incompatible or were they incompetent? Actually, maybe it wasn't. That wasn't the exact phrasing, but kind of that's what it was. Was it just that they brought the wrong kind of bowling lineup because they made a mistake, which, okay, happens. And then that bowling lineup couldn't implement the plans that they wanted anyway. Or was it the wrong bowling lineup who also didn't have the ability to do that? And on top of that, also didn't have plans. Like, do you know what I mean? That there's quite a few different parts to you know, to what you and I are both saying there, Sam. It is a fascinating one to think about. And I don't have the answers, and I'm not, clearly England don't have the answers. Cam says, I fear for the soul of the BBL. If the mooted sale of the teams goes through, surely control of the competition is more important than a short-term cash grab. Look, I mean, it was always designed, Cam, to be sold, right? So when you say the soul of it was originally, can we make these shirts in Pakistani colors to get Pakistani kids to buy the Melbourne Stars shirt, right? It was always a bit weird. I don't know how much of a soul it had. It was quite a naked commercial thing to make sure that they weren't as reliant on India or the Ashes as much as they had been in the past. So yeah, it was always a commercial thing. It's going to be fascinating because the 100 was sold and changed and it didn't really matter. I know that there's some people in the West Indies have been quite upset at times at their team sort of changing directions, but generally they've let it go in the CPL. You've now got kids who are what, 25? So not even kids anymore, but 25-year-olds who've had a BBL team that they've been supporting their whole life. And you're about to say that it's now going to be called, you know, MI Melbourne, and it's going to be the, and it's going to be a feeder for something else. There is an element of that where you're just like, okay, is that exactly the direction we want this to go? But, you know, they set it up to sell it. Then they decided not to sell it. And now they're probably going to sell it anyway. So that's how these things go, I suppose. Nadika says, in your best video, the G at the end of the line, I didn't know we did the video of that one, did we? You talk about your family's relationship to the MCG. Do you know who your first relatives to go to the MCG were? And have you taken your kids to the G and did that feel special? So yes, I wrote this piece years ago. I think it was before I was even a full-time writer at Crick Info. It's obviously a place I've talked about a lot. And it's like when people ask me what my favorite ground is, you have to take the MCG out. I can't even... It's not even a cricket ground to me. It's so much more to my family and you know part of the culture that I grew up in. My first relative on my father's side is my grandfather, who I think I talk about in that piece, who went to go see Don Bradman, who made a duck. And I think I talk about the details of that in the piece. The only reason we don't go back sort of further on that side is that he was... he was an orphan, so he was kind of the first in our line. It's only years later that we found the rest of his family. And they were in Adelaide, so they probably didn't go to the MCG. My paternal grandmother was a South Melbourne fan, so her team wasn't MCG-based, but I would assume that her and her family went to the footy occasionally. So there's possible that her or so my great grandfather or my great grandmother might have gone to the MCG at that time, but I don't remember those stories coming through. They weren't massive cricket fans on that side of the family. That I do remember. They liked cricket, but not, you know, it wasn't as culturally important as it was on my dad's side. On my grandfather's side. And then my grandmother's family was North Melbourne Football Club. And so I know that they would have gone to the MCG and they certainly talked about it. And so her family would have gone. So at least I know, what's that? Me plus three generations earlier, probably on both sides, went to football games there. Again, that side wasn't as big into cricket. So that was football. One of my, I don't know what he would be, my great uncles, was on the way to being a footballer when he got quite sick and passed away. So they were really into football, and it was like a big part of them. And being in North Melbourne, I'm assuming that when they played Melbourne, they would have gone down to the G. But not many cricket stories there. And then the other side of their family was also, from what I'm aware of, were football fans. So I would say through football, it's probably more my grandfather who was the cricket guy on that side. My kids have been to the MCG 3 or 4 times, I want to say. They went there when they were really young, and they've been through the museum 2 or 3 times. They've been to the library once. They have been on, not on Boxing Day, but it's a Boxing Day test. I'm trying to think if they've been to a Big Bash game. I don't think they have. I think they're a bit young. Me and Miriam went to the Big Bash game, but I don't think the kids came. But yeah, they've definitely been to the MCG for a bunch of cricket games. And then the last time we went back was the first time that they can kind of remember it. Like, they've got the photos. We've got actually got a photo of, like, I think it was a tour game. Zed was at a tour game. And my cousin was there. And Jesse Hogan was there. I think I've got a photo of, like, Jesse Hogan holding my son at I don't know, England versus Victoria, I suppose, something like that. All those years back, or whoever was playing, I can't even remember. It might have been India, actually. And then, yeah, we went back, what, a year and a half, 2 years ago now, maybe, in March, and there was footy being played. Sadly, Collingwood weren't playing in Victoria for the whole time I was in Australia. But we took them to see Western Bulldogs Richmond, and it was a pretty good crowd there. And they just couldn't believe it. Like, they've been to, you know, English cricket grounds before, and they've been to Selhurst Park and Brentford. So they've been to, but the MCG is just something else, right? And, you know, I remember they went up the top. So my cousin took them up the top to show them the top view down, and they both freaked out from the height, right? And they're not the only people. I've seen so many people do that over the years. But they loved the pies, which was really important to me culturally. They loved the songs at the MCG, but just the you know, walking up to it and everything, they felt like they were going to something quite cool. And I've already asked to go back multiple times. So yeah, it did feel special to be able to take them there. It was something I really wanted to do. So I used to be an MCG member because my dad put me on the list when I was like a baby. And then I was given the membership when the AFL members came in, and they basically just let in a bunch of people off the other membership to stop everyone going and taking AFL membership. So I was a member. So I actually have, I think Zachariah and Ezekiel were on the list to be members, but we kind of let that lapse. And even I'm not a member anymore because I'm not going to move back most probably. And if I do, you know, I've hopefully get free tickets now. So I was an MCG member, and they've got like little, so Clementine now wears a little beanie that says future MCC member on it, which is really, really cool as well. So it is a big part of the family. And so it was awesome to be able to go back there. Ajit said, when you hear six sixes and over, is Yuvraj Singh the first person most people think of, or is that just me? Is it just because of the whole drama that happened between the batter and the bowler that made it more entertaining? No, I suppose Garfield Sobers is probably the one I automatically think of because he was the first person to do it. So yeah, no, I don't think that's the case. I don't think, I didn't mean to click off of that so quickly. I also don't think that's like, it's what I find really interesting about that is that Shuaib Broad's had such a long and stupid career that you could almost, I would say you could forget that Broad was involved with it, but it's like, where does it rank in his obituary? Right? Like, it's a long way down his obituary, right? And yet, for Malcolm Nash against Garfield Sobers, who I think has passed on now, I don't want to say that in case he hasn't. I shouldn't say that in case he hasn't, but I know he's living in America for a long time. But it's kind of Malcolm Nash is right at the top for him, right? So it's very different. Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible now. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive Nord VPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your Nord VPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with Nord VPN. Josh says, "What an unlikely achievement! Which unlikely achievement would mean more to New Zealand? Winning 3-1 versus Australia at the end of the year, winning the ODI World Cup." Ooh, that's a really fantastic question. I suppose that's probably a better question for New Zealanders. I think it's winning the World Cup, though, isn't it? Those sort of small rivalries, right? I think in the global world, it's kind of harder to keep the steam of those things. You know, I never realized until I went to South Africa that South Africa even had a rivalry with Australia, because Australia didn't have a rivalry with South Africa. And I think that over the last 20 years, that's kind of dissipated a bit, right? Because South Africans are online and talking to people and it's changed. So I would think that winning the World Cup is much more important for New Zealand than beating Australia. Having said that, you know, at a certain point, like, they're both monkeys, right? And you want both of them off your back. Abe says, "When you work as an analyst for teams, is there a deliverable piece of analysis you'll often ask for that you think is overrated? What's the kind of analysis you wish teams asked for more often?" I think the main one I had, and I understand what this was, of Roddy Eswick, when I worked with St. Lucia, really wanted the run rate off the first ball in the over and the run rate off the last ball in the over compared to the overall run rates. And his point was that he wanted the bowlers to really think about how you open and how you close an over, that it was so important because it sets the tone. Now, if you're a bowler at this stage, close your ears, but it doesn't mean anything. Hitting a boundary off the first ball of the over does not change the expected runs of the next 5 balls. It means the over is going to go for more runs because the first ball's gone for 4 or 6, but it doesn't actually change the outcome of the next balls, or it's negligible, I should say. Right, so it's not like you hit it, you bowl a bad ball first ball and it goes for 4 and your expected runs for the rest of the over go from 7 to 9. Nothing like that. It's like from 7 to 7.05, right? But, and I told Roddy this, I said, "Look, I can give you this information, but here's why I don't like this." And he's like, "I get it. I know you don't think it's important, but when I'm working with the bowler, I really want them to think about this, right? Because it's a good way for them to switch on. Right? And it's a good way for them to finish and then feel a sense of professional accomplishment and everything else." And he said, "I just want them to be more professional. And I think this is a good way of doing that." And I 100% agree with him. What scorecards, runs are things that, like, you know, like who's got the most runs for the team? Those sorts of things I thought were a lot of overrated. Generally, they didn't know what to ask for, though, because, you know, I was at the start of this, you know, for many people, especially the more advanced stuff. What's the kind of analysis you wish teams asked for more? At that stage, the thing that I was trying to push on them was things like, we had a bowler who was dropped in one of the teams I played for because he'd gone for 40 runs. And they were like, his head's not in it at the moment. He's not in good form. And I went back through ball by ball and was like, they were out of control, the opposition against him. There was 2 edges and there was a drop catch that went for 4. If those 2 edges are plays and misses and that drop catch is taken, he ends up with 1 for 28, right? And so I was like, you can't, you need to do analysis before you're going to make this rather than just going off the scorecard. So that was the big thing. If the 2 big things in cricket is obviously the scorecard and the result, and too much weight is put on that. Whereas quite often you're with a team and you're like, we're doing everything wrong at the moment, but we've won this game. And you try to explain to the team and they're like, no, we're winning. It's fine. Right. So I think that's the bigger issue I had. MF Jim says, "Australia's transition cliff is fast approaching and a large talent gap between generations. There is a good crop of young talent that are showing promise. How would a team best facilitate this transfer with a busy 2-year schedule coming up? Cooper Conley, Beardman, Morris, Callaway, Todd Murphy, Constance, Davies brothers." Yeah, I think we did that podcast with on Kimapa where we looked at teams in 5 or 10 years time, 5 years time. And the Australians weren't happy. People from Cricket Australia, because they were like, have you seen our young players? And I was like, yeah, but your young players aren't going to be ready in 5 years, right? They're going to be still projects in 5 years. You might get one or two that pop if you're really, really lucky. But the vast majority of people at the age of 22 or 23 are not going to be consistent, successful international players. The entire history of sport has taught us that, right? So it's that other group. So I think what you really need to do if you're Australia over the next couple of years, and be interesting in how they're thinking about it, is can we get seasoned professionals that can teach these players the right habits and help us win games while also bringing through some of these guys that we also hope are going to be the next generation. What you don't want to do is the sort of 1980s thing of like, let's just throw all young players at it, because that took a long time to come, right? And I don't think that's the best way of doing it. You pick your four or five players that you think are young that you want to keep in that system. You're going to have a couple of older players who will hang around, and you're going to have a bunch of Chris Morris, Stuart Clark like cricketers that are still going to exist, right? They you may not be at the level of Stuart Clark or Chris Morris, because Chris Rogers. They may not be at that level, right? But Marcus North, right? Marcus North is a really good example of someone like this. Try to think of another bowling one, if there are any other sort of bowling ones, right? But those sorts of players, you know, a Colin Miller, which I suppose Bo Webster is kind of like a Colin Miller. Those kinds of players you want around, I think, as well, to help you win games. You know, it's unless they just think that there isn't enough of those players around, and then maybe what you do is you do a hard reset. But Australia hasn't done many of those. Hurt says, can you unpack Josh Tung? Fascinating watching him bowl, his ceiling and floor, strengths and areas he excels in. I wonder if I've done a piece on this, actually, Hurt, when he came through, because there was a period of time, and I haven't had a chance to do them in a while, where I had scouting reports for players, right, when they were coming through, especially bowlers, because that's kind of more of my pet project, I suppose. But the thing with Josh Tung is he has a very high release, but it's also a very awkward release because because he falls over a little bit and bowls from above his head. There's a touch of the Jasprit Bumrah there, but there's also a touch of the extra bounce, right? So that's a good place to be, right? To have those two skills. He's fast. He's probably not lightning fast, but he's fast enough with the awkwardness and the bounce to give himself some good skills. His biggest issue at the moment is he doesn't really have a length. And I think if he's going to be a new ball bowler, he has to work out what that length is and then hit it consistently. And he does sort of bowl a little bit too full and then a little bit too short, moving around. He just needs to find what the Josh Tung length is, which is probably in modern cricket for him is about 6.5 meters is, I think, where he should be aiming. So his worst ball should be at 5.5 meters and, you know, or 7.5 meters as much as possible. That gives him a 3 meter range where I think it would still be very hard to drive him. And it gives him a chance to be able to do that. He gets a little bit of natural sideways movement, but nothing crazy. But he seems to get it pretty consistently, so I'm pretty happy with that. I think his big thing at the moment is he's pretty good with the old ball, and he's pretty good against right-handers. How does he get new ball skills, and how does he get good against left-handers? If he can do that, he's a very special talent. If not, he's a bit of a, more of a one-dimensional bowler, but still a very handy one to have. Hurt says, not a question. I see a lot of interesting questions here week after week, but not all of your usernames on Discord. It's a party there every day, especially on match days. Come join the shenanigans. I love our Discord channel. We've obviously got a Combox one as well at the moment, which is just starting out. But thanks to everyone who's joined up there as well. That we'll get that going as things get a little bit more professional over at Combox. But yeah, I really love our Discord channel. I think it was Nick, who used to be our producer and engineer here. It was his idea. He was 100% right. And it's a great community, really smart people talking about cricket. If you can afford the Patreon, it's a great place to be. Alex says, should Australia have used the last two tests to try some different players in the team? Surprised Murphy didn't get a go. This is something we might see more of, Alex, because we're in a situation now where teams think about World Test Championship points more than ever before. And I think Australia were looking at that going, we have England down. Let's not give them a chance. They have tried Weatherald and Doggett in this series. You know, McSweeney was around not that long ago. Constance was around. Webster is a new player to the side. Even Inglis in his own kind of way, although I know he's been around the fringes a little bit longer. So I think they probably look at that and go, do you know what? We've tried quite a bit at the moment. We don't want to just throw someone in randomly. I'm okay with that. I think I would have liked to have seen Todd Murphy just to see if it's true that he's got his form back, because he has been struggling. And it might have been, it's easy for the selectors to believe he has. And I think they did believe it, even if they didn't pick him, if he's in front of them. So little things like that, maybe. Mob says Team India appear to be fielding a full strength side versus New Zealand B in a home bilateral ODI series. What can India possibly stand to gain or learn from doing so, other than which players they have injured by the completion of this series? A lot of this, Mob, has to do with your players, right? If you talk to your players and they're all like, do you know what? We've got a bunch of T20 cricket coming up. We just like some time in the middle, going through our spells, problem solving in real time and everything else. It's a younger side. Might also be that Gambier is just one of those guys who doesn't like rest and rotation. But I don't think there's a problem with doing it, as long as you know why you're doing it. If you're just doing it because you think the best Indian team should go out every time, that is possibly an issue. But if that's not why they're doing it, I think that's okay if they've got a real reason. James says, can do national boards direct domestic boards on team selection, tactics, etc., in order to serve the national team's interest, where that might conflict with the domestic team's interest? Do they have the authority to flex in order to get what they want? So this is really interesting. I had a conversation recently with a couple of people in cricket, and we were talking about this exact thing of, so Jamie Smith shouldn't be playing at Surrey, right? Not that he's not good enough to play for Surrey or anything else. It's just that Jamie Smith can't wicketkeep enough when he's at Surrey. And if England really believed that Jamie Smith is the wicketkeeper of the future, they need to get as much wicketkeeping into him now as possible. And he hasn't done a lot of wicketkeeping in his life. So it would make sense for Jamie Smith to be moved from Surrey to another team. English cricket doesn't work that way. I pointed out another one of recent times where you had Glenn Maxwell and Matthew Wade openly fighting for the number four position for Victoria, when it was like, surely someone just has to come in and move one of them to another state. Surely that makes, it's better for Australian cricket if both of them are knocking on the door, because they both offer really good skill sets Australia might need. It doesn't make sense for them to be fighting amongst themselves for that position. It's just not the way that cricket has been run. Cricket Australia certainly has, I would say, more influence than most. But when it comes down to it, they're not. Cricket Australia isn't in the change room. Like, George Bailey isn't in the change room on the day of selection. He isn't there when the batting order goes out and the team's trying to win. And there's good things and bad things from that as well. Like, you actually want, you know, one of Shield Cricket's big strengths has always been that people are playing to win and they take it really seriously. But at the same time, this causes some issues where it's like, actually, we'd like so-and-so to bat at number six. We don't think he's going to help us to win. We don't care, because we're going to need him in 2 years' time to win us a test match, where he will help us to win. We understand tomorrow he may not help you win in this game. So, yeah, it's very much still in flux, and it is a uncomfortable, I would say, alliance between them all. There needs to be better conversations. I think sometimes it's just about the conversations. I think a lot of times the boards go in and they believe they know what's best for the players, and the teams are like, well, wait a minute, we're the one who made this player good in the first place that got them to the level that you think they're good. We know. And I know of first-class teams who have had that conversation directly. But there's also situations where, like, you look at some of the, you look at somewhere like India, and maybe Sri Lanka would be another one, where you have like all these first-class teams, and you have so much talent concentrated in, like, you know, Bengaluru, Mumbai, Chennai, you know, those sorts of incredible talent-making areas, right? And there's like four or five of them, where their second 11s are probably better than many other states' first 11. But actually, don't you want to start to spread that talent out more? So that you have lots of different, and who knows if the backup, like, you know, I don't want to say this has happened in Indian cricket, but it probably has. That sort of, let's call it the Neil Wagner issue, right? When Neil Wagner couldn't get into, there weren't many teams in South Africa. He couldn't get into his team. They picked two other young players over him. The senior players were like Steyn, Nell, the Mulker brothers. So they were like, do we really need another guy like this? We've got this young guy, we think he bowls a bit quicker than Wagner. We've got this other guy we think, you know, might be the, you know, next big thing as well. We're going to go with them over Wagner. And Wagner ends up leaving, or, you know, worse in somewhere like India's case, where if you're just playing in the background the whole time. So that probably happens in lots of first-class places. So that's where the national bodies, I think, need to be more involved and understand these things. Hayden says, should we be more scientific with session times in Test cricket? having a 40-minute break after 2 hours of play and then a 20-minute break after 4 hours is probably not the best way to optimize athletic performance. Hayden, I love this question. Yes. I don't understand why it's not half an hour and half an hour, by the way. No one in cricket has ever fully explained to me why we can't do that. A lot of players don't even eat in the lunch breaks anymore, right? It's not the way, you know, it's really hard to eat in a lunch break and then go out and bowl. You know, I'm not saying they don't snack, but they have enough time if they need it. Players quite often eat in the tea break as well. Like, so an extra 10 minutes there would help. It's just, there's no better answer than this, Hayden, than it's what we've always done, so we do it. It doesn't make sense. I'm with you. I think there is an element of the fan perspective where you're like, well, it makes more sense to have the lunch break at that time. But then in day-night cricket, we don't make it better anyway. We still do all sorts of weird things for day-night cricket. So I'm with you 100%. We should be changing this. I think the dogmatic belief in a lot of it has to do with corporate stuff as well. We gotta move on. We're done here. Neil says, has this summer and Ashes changed how good you think Crawley is, can be, or is likely to become? No, I don't think so. I was not fearing that Crawley was going to make a lot of runs this Ashes, and that I would be seen as wrong. I was pretty confident that he would do roughly what Crawley does. I thought he'd have a couple of good innings, which I probably had two and a half good innings off the top of my head. But I also thought he'd give them away. I kind of expected 100, but a lot of failures. In the end, he didn't even give us the 100. I probably expected him to average around 33, 34, and he averaged 27. I still think, again, I was having a chat with a bunch of cricket people recently about Crawley. I still think that, like, if the management change, they're going to drop Crawley right at the time he might hit his peak. I hope that they don't just say he's never going to make runs and he was picked too often and, like, there's baggage against him. What should happen is he should be dropped. They should try other players. And then if those other players aren't doing well and he's doing well, he gets another chance. That is how it should work for a player of his natural talent. But he has to go back and prove that he has run-making skills, and he has never proved that anywhere in his entire career so far. When he can prove that, I'm like, he gets another chance. He has a lot of the skills that he needs to make runs in Test cricket. But he doesn't have that one. And that's the most important one, I would argue. So if he can work that out, he comes back. I don't want to be in a situation where he gets blamed for McCullum and Stokes and Key giving him too many chances, because that's not his fault. That's their fault. They made the error here. They made two huge errors with Crawley. The first one is just telling him he would be fine eventually and that he would be perfect for Australia. And that's just fundamentally not true. And I disagree with it 100%. The second one is that by telling him that they knew he was flawed, but they liked the way he played, he never got better at anything else. I don't blame Crawley for what has happened to him. I blame the system that he went into. So, no, I think he's more or less the same player I've always said. He can play very good shots. He sees the ball quite early. His height is a huge advantage to him. But he has technical flaws, and he doesn't know how to score runs. He does not know how to progress in an innings at all. Ali says, considering the two new PSL teams went for record fees, what do you make of the financial feasibility of both leagues coexisting during the same window? Yeah, I actually think it's a great idea. I'm not too worried about them being in the same window at all. I kind of like the idea of you going, I mean, no one believes this is going to be a bigger league than the IPL, and that's fine. So embrace that and be like, okay, so we can get the aging IPL players on the way down. We might be able to get the young IPL overseas players on the way up. We can get the coaches who are out of favor with the IPL who even should be in the IPL at the moment. But we're actually making a product for Pakistan. And that is where I think a lot of those leagues around the world have always been. A lot of those leagues are still trying to make a product for India, right? South Africa, even though it's owned by the Indian owners, that is a product for South Africa. The Big Bash is a product for Australia. The 100 is a product for England. That's your best bet if you have that market. If you don't have that market, that's when you should be maybe, you know, trying to work out if you can have multiple countries involved and you can have like a multi-team league. But Pakistan should be able to get a market like that. And so for them being up against the IPL doesn't bother me at all. PJ says, Jokic hates basketball. Okay, just on this. Everyone frames this wrong in the NBA, and I'm not a basketball writer, so I've never had a chance to write this. Jokic does not hate basketball. He hates the NBA. And he really does. He hates having to do press conferences all the time. He hates having to update people on how he's feeling. He hates having to ask questions about, like, Twitter fights, right? He hates having to deal with someone who's called him a stat patter, right? All that sort of stuff he absolutely hates. He hates the parade they sent for him. That he hates. He loves basketball. Watch him on the bench at the moment for the Nuggets. And watch him going over and coaching the players. Listen to him talking about Serbian basketball. He watches, like, overseas basketball all the time. He listens to coaching seminars in other countries. This is a dude that really, really loves basketball. But he hates the NBA. And that's the thing that I think is quite interesting that hasn't been talked about enough. So if you're doing it on that perspective, there are some people who absolutely love cricket who just hate the nonsense of it. And I think that's probably fair. I'm trying to think if there's, like, a good player. So I worked with David Warner at St. Lucia, and David Warner went out of his way to say he didn't watch a lot of cricket. But if I sent him a clip or if I was looking at something, he would get just as engrossed in it as everyone else. But he didn't want his whole day to be cricket. I think there's a lot of David Warner guys out there, you know, that sort of, in England, it's the kind of golfing guys. In Australia, it's a little bit of the golfing guys as well. It's also the guys who love baseball or basketball. You know, even in India, I think there's a little bit of that, like, they love being cricketers, but they'd love to be as cool as the footballers. Like, I think there's a lot of that sort of element. There's a lot of players who absolutely hate cricket by the end of their career, and then they're out of it for 5 years, and they come back, and they love it again. Sometimes it's just that. And I think again with Joker, I think that's part of the Joker thing as well. It's like, he would love basketball if it wasn't 82 games or 115 games or whatever he has, 100 games or whatever he has to play, to win a championship. And I think there's a lot of players who feel that way. You know, I think there are guys like Mark Butcher who have a genuine love-hate relationship with it. And I've talked about that openly before. There are a lot of guys who would go out of their way to almost never. I remember Andrew Simons saying around me once that he didn't watch cricket when he wasn't being paid for it, because it was like his whole life had been cricket, right? And it was too much. I think there's a lot of that. I can't think of anyone, let's say we believe that the Jokic thing is true. I don't think it's anyone hates cricket. I just think that they maybe wish that they had skills in other things, right? And they've could have gone on and played. I think there's a lot of those sorts of people. I think that's very fair. Ben says, is Boomer the fastest bowler ever? Hear me out. Okay, so he's making the physics argument here. Ben, we have got this question. I can't answer it today. I think Jimenez and Varun have been looking at this question. I don't know if they've given an answer because I forgot to follow up with them. But if we can work it out, we will try and work it out for you and come back to you on it. But it's a fantastic question. Basically, because Bumrah bowls from closer than everyone else because of his action, is it possible he's the fastest bowler ever? I think there's a lot to be said for that being a possibility, by the way. As I've said before, the speed gun doesn't matter with him because he's already changing the pitch. Ali says, why doesn't the ICC host an annual T20 tournament? They're almost there. Surely broadcasters and smaller boards would also want that, and also could indirectly give ICC more control over the game. Okay. Who runs the ICC? It's the major boards. Why does the ICC have so many tournaments at the moment? Because for a little while, the ICC was slightly more independent and was run by people who were trying to get some power back. And that's why we have so many trophies. And then since then, you know, the last 6 or 7 years, power has gone back to specifically India in this case, right? He would have to okay anything. So you're asking why Jay Shah would want to do this. That might cause issues if the BCCI want to do a second tournament or they want more time in the window and everything else, right? On top of that, I don't think we need a T20 tournament every year, Ali. I think it would be better to have one 50-over tournament, the Olympics, and then one Champions Trophy, which is probably going to be T20, and then one T20 World Cup. That's how I would do it. I think that's the perfect system for men and for women. Maybe it's a little bit more confusing because of the Commonwealth Games, and you've also, you know, so I don't know how that works into that structure. But that for me is, that means every year there is a major cricket event happening. There's a ton of money to be gained, and we can grow the game at the same time. I once made a pair in a club game, which is almost impossible to do. But I have been obsessed with batting my entire life. And so I put that into my new book, The Art of Batting. Being that I'm not very good at that skill, I decided to talk to other people who were. So I hit up as many contacts as I could just to talk about batting. Rahul Dravid, Brian Lara, AB de Villiers, Kumar Sangakkara, Ross Taylor, Susie Bates, Nasser Hussain, Ian Chappell, and so many, many, many more. I wanted batters to talk about how they and their friends made runs, because that is the art of batting. Prithvi says, do you have any resources regarding how to take care of children starting to play sports cricket? I want to make sure their love of the sport stays while providing the steps needed for excellence if they choose. Project Bradman coming soon. So the way that I have tried to do it, so obviously I have coached a little bit of basketball, and I coached a bit more of tennis and a bit more of cricket. And one of my boys doesn't play sport at all anymore. He's much more into other things and he's loving them. So I push him towards that. Pushing him towards sport, or even allowing him an environment to try sport, just didn't work. There was nothing I was going to be able to do that was going to make him do it. He might come back to it. There's a couple of sports I think he's quite good at that he might come back to later. But at the moment, he's cool and he's happy. And that's more important to me than him liking sport, right? His brother is sport obsessed and had a podcast on this network and might come back to having a podcast on this network, and I think wants to be involved again. Absolutely loves cricket, absolutely loves basketball, plays tennis as well. Are they the only three he does? I think they're the three main sports he has at the moment. Last year he played for two different cricket teams. He's playing school basketball, and probably it's at the point now where he's pretty good at tennis. We might have to try and find him some sort of tennis competition to play in as well, right? I push both of the kids exactly the same. You just have to trust that the kids go in the way that they do. What I have tried to do as a person, as a former coach, is I try and give as much distance as possible. When my kids play tennis, I stand about 50 meters away so that I cannot give them too much coaching when they come off the court. I found the right coaches. I trust the right coaches. I keep an eye on it so I know what's happening. And so I can work on things with him if we go and have a hit. And we quite often have a hit before lessons as well. But he's happy with it. He really likes it. He's having fun. That's what I will continue to do with him. And that's now what I'm doing with the sister as well. I sometimes go up a little bit close with the sister just because she's five. And I want to just make sure that, you know, she's listening to the coaches and she's understanding what she needs to do. And I haven't pushed her too heavily. But I do a little bit of coaching with the cricket club that they both play at. So she's playing at the same club that her brother plays at. I try not to coach them any differently than I do the kids. I struggle with Ezekiel a little bit sometimes, only because I quite often do some stuff with him. But again, I want him to be asking me to do things rather than me asking him to do things. So during the summer, he's like, we have to do throwdowns. We have to do throwdowns. So we do throwdowns, right? I have to say no sometimes because he wants them, and he also wants them to go for about 2 hours, and my shoulder eventually, I don't have a very good shoulder. Same with one-on-one basketball. It's only recently he started working with other basketball coaches, but up until recently I was his coach. And again, I am coaching him in basketball, but I also don't want to be the person dragging him out to the court. He has to want to do it. And I think that's the big thing I've learned with all the three of the kids so far is if they don't want to do it, find something else that they want to do. And if it's not the thing that you love, that's fine, as long as it's the thing that they love. That is the most important thing is trust that the coaches that you've got are the right coaches. And I say this as a coach. The people who are micromanaging their kids while I was trying to coach them quite often are just saying the wrong things anyway, right? And on top of that, even if they're saying the right things, they're trying to coach them for something else that we're not ready for at the moment, right? This kid isn't ready for, and I'm trying to get the kid ready for something else. So make sure that they love the thing they do, and then that they have as many opportunities to do it as possible, right? That's the big thing for me, of just allow them to be in the environment of sport. Reece says, how much AI is used to professional cricket team preparations, do you think? I think some of the IPL teams would be using it. There's probably a couple of other analysts that are using some of it. England maybe is using it. I think Australia flirted with it. Don't think India's doing it, so I don't think there'd be many international teams doing it. But yeah, I think there'd certainly be some in franchise teams. I couldn't give you an exact thing, but yeah, I would say there's some out there. James says, did the Ashes debacle give much chance to a recall for Ollie Robertson? It's worth having a look at the podcast I've done on TalkSport, which may not be up yet, with Steve Harmison and John Norman, where we talk about the Ollie Robertson thing. Ollie Robertson certainly has his issues with the current setup. I think Steve Harmison was pretty clear that they don't trust him and that is an issue. I think they now need new ball bowling, and he's probably their best new ball bowler, right? Like, even including Jofra, he's just on skills-wise, he's probably their best new ball bowler. There's a lot of issues with Ollie Robertson around that team and the structure. A new team might be able to change that, but I think Ollie has to take a lot of responsibility. I do think there's a better way of using him, though, which I don't think England did, which is, and maybe this is because Broad and Anderson were around, but if they have Ollie Robertson in this current side, right, Jofra takes the new ball at one end, Ollie takes it at the other, and he bowls the first 10 overs, 8 overs, whatever it is, as long as he can, right, until he's not bowling well. Then you give him a break, and then you bring him back on for while the ball's still newish and doing something for another spell. And then you allow the old ball bowlers, of which you have Tung, Cass, a spinner, Stokes. They can do all that other job. You don't need Ollie Robinson to do that. That's the genius of a 5-man bowling attack. You've got a new ball specialist. Oh. Will says, how on earth were England allowed to spend a week in a casino complex? Surely anti-match fixing regulations should ban such locations being too risky. So there are international teams who stay in casinos, Will. I hate to break this to you. I think in St. Kitts, most teams would stay in a casino. Like a hotel complex with a casino in it in St. Kitts would be pretty regular, Will. I'm trying to think if there are any other places around the world. I don't think anyone stays in the Crown Casino in Melbourne. All the hotels are next door, but I don't think they stay in it. Or I can't remember. But I'm sure teams have maybe stayed in some of the properties. I'm trying to think if there's any others, Will. I would assume there's others that I don't know about or have forgotten. It's not ideal. I can tell stories of players who are not from gambling backgrounds being in the hotels is... Forget match fixing. It's just an issue. The same rules, though, apply whether it's a casino or it's a hotel. The anti-corruption unit are monitoring who is coming in of the hotel, of the casino and who's going out. And in casinos' cases, it's actually much easier to tell who's talking to players than anywhere else. I know that sounds weird, but, you know, there is an element of that. I'm not saying you're wrong. But, yeah, there is. It is quite tricky. I suppose, you know, it's no different than playing professional sport in Las Vegas. I would assume all of those have casinos in them. I don't think it's a match fixing issue as much as it's a welfare issue. But you also make a point. Like there is that there as well. Cam says, how much do franchise T20 teams factor in a player's popularity status compared to performance? Surely the likes of Shaheen and Rizwan wouldn't have got picked up in a BBL on recent performances alone. Yeah, it's a huge part of it. I don't know about the Big Bash because I haven't been there for a while. When I was with the Big Bash, it wasn't about the players. When I was with the Melbourne Stars. But the Melbourne Stars was a pretty big team, so maybe they didn't have to worry about it as much at that stage. I don't know. But yeah, it's definitely a huge... Even in the IPL, it's a thing, right? It really is a bigger thing than people understand. Owners like to hang out with famous people. Marketing people would rather have a big name than a small name. All these things are 100% true. I think it's right across professional sport you will find this, but I think cricket is more run as a novelty from a business point of view in the way that it should be. So I do think there's an element of it in lots of leagues. Ajit says, when a leg spinner starts bowling googlies more than 75% of the time, should they even be classified as leg spinners? Wouldn't it be better to just classify players as wrist or finger spinners, depending on how they spin the ball, rather than what their supposed stock delivery would be? I've also seen stats of many bowlers that actually have their stock ball as the one that turns back in rather than what they are labeled as. Yeah, I mean, the first thing you would have to say then is, Ajit, is who is keeping the stats on how often they're spinning in either direction and how available those stats are to all the people around the world that are calling that person that thing. I think this is a dream situation, Ajit, right? We're not even there yet. I'm actually okay with wrist spinner because I think wrist spinner, leg spinner, because I just think leg spinner means wrist spinner, right? And you do, I think on Crick Info for a while, they did try and go through and have the sort of leg spin googly category of bowlers. So I'm pretty sure I remember that. Even in the stats, you could see that. But it's so hard to keep on track of. And you've got like Ashwin bowling leg spin quite a bit one year. You've got Varun Chakravarti, who doesn't fit any of the categories that we have for most of his career, and then has changed anyway. In a perfect world, I think this is what we would, probably the sort of thing that we would move towards on Combox in the future is what you're talking about. But I don't think I would change it from wrist spinner from leg spinner to wrist spinner. I still think of Varun Chakravarti as a wrist spinner who bowls wrong-ins. As a leg spinner who bowls wrong-ins, right? I've got no issue with that, a part of it. And then you can use wrist spinner or finger spinner interchangeably as well. I don't have a huge issue with those sorts of things. Abe says, what's your favorite example of a player facing a technical problem over a stretch of their career and then genuinely solving it? Mitchell Starc would be one at the moment that I can't get past. I mean, 4 years ago when he'd forgotten how to swing the ball, I was just like, God, have they ruined him by accident? I'm trying to think of someone else. Jason Roy reverse sweeping the wrist spinners in T20 cricket. I thought that was genius of just being like, okay, well, I can't hit you, so let's make it even riskier. But you're now going to have to bowl differently to me as well. You can't bowl the normal deliveries, and you're going to have to set a whole new field. And you know, I want to hit down the ground, and now you've got to put a guy out here. I thought that was genius, and he probably went to it slightly too much. But wow, what a way to not even solve a technical deficiency, just go, good luck. Trying to think of something else. I think Brendan McCullum with the coming down the crease to people and just going, I'm not worried about nicking off. You should be worried about me slicing over deep backward point for four. I absolutely love that. And that has changed cricket really dramatically. That's probably my favorite story off the top of my head, Abe. And you know, Neil Wagner not swinging the ball back in. And the bouncers, is that another one? Those are probably the ones that come to my head. MF Jim says, with some pundits calling for McCullum's head, who would be a good candidate for a young team? Justin Langer and Darren Lehman have been mentioned. I wouldn't hire either of those. Jason Gillespie, I wouldn't hire him. Ryan Campbell or Paul Farbrace, a little bit more interested now. Are there other coaches you think they should look at? Gareth Batty, Vikram Solanki, if he wants to come back to coaching. Gareth Batty, Vikram Solanki, who else would you throw in there? I like the idea of a kind of a Mike Hessen, Mickey Arthur type of coach as well. Andy Flower is now a better coach than he ever was before. Can he come back? Probably not, but a better coach than he's ever been before. I'm missing someone. Chris Rogers is another name I've heard mentioned a little bit. Phil Simmons is maybe just past it now, right? But those are, you know, I'm just saying for Phil Simmons, I'm not sure he wants to travel around the world. Well, maybe he does. I don't know. Mob says, pick one from column A and one from column B. Now make a Combox Venture Capital limited billion-dollar cricket-themed IP. A horror sci-fi fantasy. B, a musical full-length feature YouTube short series. I have an idea, which is a sitcom that I wrote years ago, that perhaps under Combox can be made again, one way or another, which is probably a mashup of A and B in some ways, but certainly more A. It's cricket-based, but it's also genre-based, but it's not one genre, it's multiple genres. I think I'd probably go with A. Neil says, Bo Webster and Green for Australia, England with Jacks, India with Reddy and Washington. Clearly, they all believe strengthening the lowing order is a legit winning strategy versus playing specialist bowls to chase 20 wickets. Are they actually wrong in terms of the value of the extra runs? A lot of this is not just about that, Neil. It's also about making sure that you have more than four bowling options now because teams play back-to-back games. So I think that's part of it. Also, once you have a genuine all-rounder on your side, you are better than 11 players. So the upside of that is bigger than the upside of four great bowlers and six great batters. If you can have five great batters and a great all-rounder and four great bowlers, you are a much better side than the previous one I just mentioned. So I think it's a combination of all of those things at the moment, why we're seeing that. PJ says, if an associate country started a new 16 franchise league tomorrow and their nearest full member neighbor offered to send them six players out of kindness and had to develop the league, what type of player roles should you be looking at? So I worked with Scotland when it was going to be the Euro League, right? Not with Scotland, with the Edinburgh Rocks. And when we were looking at players for overseas roles, and I would do the exact same thing here, PJ. It was like, what does Scotland not produce? Right? Is it left arm seam? Is it tall seam? It wasn't tall seam. They had plenty of tall seam. But what is it that wrist spinners? What is it that they do not produce? That's what you go for. That's how you top up that system. Ben says, instead of finding teams that made spinning surfaces, imagine the ECB financially incentivized a couple of counties to make very spin-friendly grounds. Would that long-term benefit the England team in terms of spinners and batting against spin? Yeah, it would. I still think the better option is, I'm not saying don't do that, because I'd like to see where that would go. What if they just picked five grounds and just went, we will give you money to do this thing? But I also think the other option is playing overseas games would make a lot more sense as well. Reece says, surely there's a middle ground around media related to ex-England players over the outrage of what's happened in the Ashes. Two teams involved, someone has to lose. And McCullum basically saying, my way or the highway. Oh, okay. Professional sports people in 25-26 should not be getting pissed before a game of professional sport. I don't think I fully explained this, and I'll probably make a short video of it and put it up on Instagram and on YouTube shorts and everything. But I made a video about McCullum specifically, and I said, the issue isn't that McCullum is wrong or terrible or that he doesn't have good ideas. The issue is that McCullum's ideas needed someone like a Mike Hessen, right? Or a Venky from KKR. It needed other adults in the room to say, that's good, that's bad. That makes sense, that doesn't make sense. And they didn't do that. I think that's the issue here. There's a lot of, you're right about the middle ground. Like, not everyone must go. Like, I made a joke on TalkSport. It's like, oh, the manager has to be fired. This is what we talk about on TalkSport, right? I think we have to be a bit more realistic here and you know, try and find a middle ground, I suppose, is what you're saying here, Reece, which I 100% agree with. But at the same time, like, if you're getting pissed the night before you're playing in a major sporting event, there's something wrong with the entire culture. And so maybe you could make an argument they all should go. Will says, do you think there's a problem with McCullum not getting the scrutiny England players are under or the rigors of a five-test series because the players didn't have to face them? Think McCullum's got plenty of scrutiny, hasn't he? Do you think there's a problem with not getting the scrutiny England players right? Oh, okay, I see what you're saying. No, because then you couldn't be a coach if you've never played in a five-test series before. That doesn't really make any sense. He would have played in seven-match in ODI series, probably. Maybe did New Zealand play in those? I think they did a couple times. Or five-match ODI series. So the basic thing is there. No. Your coach does not have to be someone who has played in five-match test series. That is not their job. He's been through trials and tribulations. In New Zealand, McCullum is more famous than most English cricketers are in England, right? That's a very different factor that he's had to deal with in his career. He's had to deal with being the face of franchises that aren't doing particularly well in the IPL as well. And I think he actually handles those pressures better than most people. Unfortunately, the way he handles those pressures won't work for every single person. I think that's part of the issue that we have here. But no, I'm not worried about the fact he never played in a five-test series. Otherwise, you could never hire a coach that hadn't played in the exact same. That just doesn't make any sense to me at all. And if the best coach in the world is a Bangladeshi domestic player who never played international cricket, then you pick that person. Surely. Let's just run through the super chats as well. We have five of them. RCB says, if the ball nicks the bat and hits the stumps without dislodging the bails and then the keeper takes it, will it be out? Yes, that is out. That was easy. Thank you, RCB. Andy says, are Rohit Bumrah and MSD in the all-time ODI 11? I don't really have an all-time ODI 11. So that's one of those questions. It's a good question. Don't get me wrong. But it's very hard for me to answer that without knowing what my 11 already is. And I don't think I've ever made an all-time. I mean, I probably have. I've probably made everything. But I don't have one off the top of my head. I don't think Rohit is in it. But I'd have to go through the openers and see. Maybe he is. I think Bumrah is in it. I think Dhoni's in it if you want a keeper, you know. But maybe you could pick. Maybe you've also got the flexibility of Gilchrist and Butler and De Villiers, right? Depending on how you want to go. But I would say that off the top of my head, the second two make more sense. The first one is a possibility. I would have to go through all the openers and work out where I come. Andy says, has SA20 measurably boosted popularity there? I think it has. You say measurably, like I'm not measuring it. I get the feeling it has from the outside and from people that are over there. But that might be a better one for someone like Neil Manthorpe. Blue Eagle says, Matra or Vaibhav of the highest ceiling? Ooh. I suppose no one has a ceiling like Suryavanshi, does it? Like, so I would go with him because I think his ceiling is ridiculous. But maybe Matra has the higher floor? Oh, see where I went there. A says, I just don't see Gil's imprint on the team. I have not seen a flash of tactical genius from him. Am I missing something or is he just a PR pick? Young captain? Like, I haven't seen anything that suggests he shouldn't be captaining. Do you know what I mean? Like, a lot of captains become captains when they're 100% sure what they want to do as captains. He's become a captain because the team's kind of fell around, separate to him. So I think that's a pretty normal thing. I think I have seen an imprint on the team. The tactical genius, no, probably not at the moment. And he might never be that kind of captain. Not every captain is a tactical genius, right? And you don't, that's the easy thing to see, Ace. The harder thing to see is he making his players feel comfortable? Are his players better used under him? Has he found a way to upskill people and use them in roles that suit them? No one ever talks about that. It's all like, oh, he should have put a third slip in. It's easy to say that. It's hard to say the other one. That's how he'll ultimately be tested, I think. Walnut says, does the USA have any recourse regarding Ali Khan's visa being denied for the T20 World Cup? I had not seen this story. We've had players have their visas denied originally. My visa gets denied for India quite regularly. And I've only just found out recently why that is. And now I found it out. It's actually much easier for me to get a visa to India in the future. Generally, the players have got their visas and they have sorted it out. But I've said this a million times, Walnut, cricket has a huge problem with visas. The ICC don't want to do anything about it. None of the cricket boards want to do anything about it until it's one of their players. And then everyone goes, oh, we've got to fix it. This is something that could be fixed. Jack says, really disappointed by the fact that Fierce may not get paid for his ouster. Politics aside, players need more protection and respect. Ridiculous, isn't it? If that's what happens, it is absolutely ridiculous that there is not a payoff for this. And too often in too many leagues, I see this happen where it has nothing to do with the player. We've got to protect players a lot better. Unfortunately, this is also why a lot of players from the subcontinent are not from union countries and they don't understand what the union can do for them. If every cricket team in the world was, or at least 90% of them were involved in unions, a lot of this stuff could actually be sorted by unions directly, right? And at the moment, it's the players getting mucked around. It has nothing to do with this whole nonsense has nothing to do with Mustafiz Rahman. He got in some good form. He got picked for this draft. He should be getting paid, right? Even if it's not the full amount, there should be a cancellation clause that is available to him. And I'd be very disappointed if that does not happen. Anyway, I'm done. Sub to Combox. I've got a podcast with a bunch of people, actually. Robbie coming up, Steve Harmison, Deepak, the rest of the team. Those ones I can't remember. I've done a bunch with Baron. Please subscribe, follow, support Combox. I promise you a lot more is coming very, very soon. And I'll see you next time. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly.
There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.